Glad to be here talking, and thank you everyone for coming. So today I'll be talking about spin liquids, and what I'll be telling you about today is a couple different projects. And so these different projects have had different collaborators, but this is the list of the people who I've worked on the things that I'll be talking about today. So what is the game in condensed matter physics? Well, the game in condensed matter physics is we think about different phases. There are lots of different phases out there. There are phases like semi-metals and valence bond crystals and nail states. And in some sense, we think of a lot of these phases as boring. And the reason that we think about them as boring is that we think we largely understand it. Either we know we have Landau's theory of phase transitions or Fermi liquid theory, and these things really are sort of well established, and largely we understand those things. Now, of course, even for these states, some things are hard. So, for example, if you wanted to write down on the Hubbard model a good wave function of a nail state, you could write something that prototypically looked right, but if you really wanted to be good and say, look, I want the energies to be very accurate, it turns out even that is still pretty hard. But overall, these are the sort of states that we understand. And there are other states, sort of more exotic states, that we understand less. And one of those states is the spin liquid state. Again, a phase of matter. And this phase of matter has some exotic properties. There aren't any local order parameters, it's topological, it's different than these other things. And this is the phase that I'll be talking about throughout the rest of the talk today. So this talk is really going to be a tale of three different spin liquids. So let me introduce you to these different spin liquids, and then I can tell you a little bit about them. So we have a Hamiltonian. We're going to talk about two different Hamiltonians here. One of them is the Hubbard model, in this case at half filling. And one of them is the Heisenberg model, either with just a J1 coupling nearest neighbor or a J1, J2 coupling. We're going to be talking about these different Hamiltonians on different lattices. So we'll be talking about the Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice. So this is a spin liquid that was first identified by Meng, Asad, Miramatsu, and company. And they have strong numerical evidence that the honeycomb lattice Hubbard model has a spin liquid state in some range of U over T, specifically between 3.5 and 4.3. So we're going to tell a story about this and try to understand a little bit about how to think about this, and in particular, can we do a better job of identifying this spin liquid? And I'll tell you why it would be nice to be able to do a better job and what that means in a second. The second spin liquid we'll talk about is the J1, J2 model on the Heisenberg lattice. And one might think of that as an effective spin degree of freedom for the Hubbard model. And there I'm going to be talking about a spin liquid state that we have identified, at least at the variational level, on this system. But I'm not going to be talking primarily about whether or not the spin liquid state is just there or not. When you do variational Monte Carlo, these things are hard. The energies could shift a little bit. What we'll be talking about is, can we understand if there's a spin liquid state, which one is here? What type is it? Can we sort of name it? Can we look at the PSG classification? Can we figure out which of them is this spin liquid state? And then can we understand why? That'll be the main goal of that part of the talk. And then we'll also be talking about the Kagame lattice. Again, there's strong numerical evidence from Yan, White, and Hughes that argues that on the Kagame lattice, there is a spin liquid, a Z2 spin liquid. And we'll be trying to understand, again, similar questions. Can we identify what type of spin liquid is it? Do the typical analytical considerations, RVB wave functions, PSG wave functions, do they make sense for this system? And so those are the three things that we're going to do today. Let's start with the Hubbard model, though. But before I really do that, why don't I tell you why we're bothering studying spin liquids? Well, really, the best reason is that there's been recent experimental evidence. There are more and more materials that keep coming out that are better and better candidates for the existence of a spin liquid. So that's good motivation. And the other motivation is that spin liquids are interesting. RVB states are relevant to them, and that has some relevance to high TC. They're not described by the typical things. They're topological, et cetera, et cetera. So that's our motivation. That's why we're going to study them. So what's the problem with spin liquids? Why is it hard? Why isn't all of this sort of settled at this point? Well, just in the way that sort of black holes have no hair, spin liquids really have no hair. They're really featureless states. There's no magnetic order, no local order parameters, no way to poke at it locally and tell what it is, no symmetry breaking. It makes it really hard to learn about something if it's identified primarily by what it's not. Okay, it's either got a gap or it's gapless, but other than that, it's largely identified by what it doesn't have. So this is a bit strange. I just told you a minute ago that there are these other groups, and they had strong numerical evidence for the existence of these spin liquid states. So what did I mean when I said they had strong numerical evidence for the existence of these states? Well, let's talk about the case of Assad and company. They've done amazing calculation, extremely impressive. And what have they really shown? Well, they've essentially written down all of the symmetry breaking states they can imagine, all of the local order parameters they can imagine, and they've extrapolated them all, and they're all zero. So they've essentially ruled out all of the things that it's not. And they said, well, it's not any of those things, therefore it must be a spin liquid. And this is sort of an amazing thing to do, very impressive, but it still is a little bit dissatisfying. The reason it's dissatisfying is we've essentially identified the spin liquid by arguing that it's not any of these other people. So what else can we do? I mean, I just told you it's largely featureless. Well, they've identified that the spin liquid is gapped. And typically, if you have a gap Z2 spin liquid, in fact, not typically, by definition, if you have a gap Z2 spin liquid, then it has to have this property that is topological. So what do we mean by topological in this case? Well, the topology is manifested in the following way. It's manifested by the fact that it knows what manifold it lives on. So if you stick this thing on a torus, what you'll discover is you discover there's a four-fold degeneracy. You stick it on a cylinder, there should be a two-fold degeneracy. You stick it on something else, it will be some complicated degeneracy. So in some sense, you might say this is really the positive smoking gun of the spin liquid. You could stick it on these different manifolds and you could find the degeneracy. That would really be nice. Now you might say, look, it's gotta be there if everything I've told you is true so far, because there's this famous theorem of Hastings. You have no symmetry breaking, and you're gapped, therefore you must be topological. So it'd be nice to find it, but it has to be there. But it turns out that in this case, that's not true. Hastings' theorem specifically says you have no symmetry breaking and gap, and one site per unit cell, then you must be topological. But the honeycomb lattice has two sites per unit cell. So there's no rule, there's nothing that says that this necessarily has to be topological. So beyond being a nice verification, sort of the smoking gun of being a spin liquid, it also helps us verify that this is not something else. So this is going to be the game for the next couple slides. We're going to ask, can we find the topological nature? If we can't, can we bound sort of how unlikely it is to exist? Okay. So what would we like to do? Would we like to just stick this into some big exact diagonalization, look at the spectra, read off whether the spectra has degeneracies or not? That's the game we would like to play. But unfortunately, we can't do that because we can't do exact diagonalization on big enough systems. But why do we need big systems? Well, if we could do a thermodynamic system, this is what the world should look like. There should be four degenerate ground states if you live on a torus. There should be a gap to the first excited state, which in this case happens to be a triplet. Okay, if you're only working on a finite system, on a small system, this four-fold degeneracy breaks. It's going to break like this. There are going to be four states that are low in the spectra and close. These will become degenerate as the system gets big. And then there's a gap again to the spin triplet. So if we could just do a big exact diagonalization, we'd look at the spectra would look like this, we would declare success, and we would be done. But we can't do that. So we have to ask, how do we get at the information that we need to get at without being able to do exact diagonalization? And the tool that we'll use today is we'll use quantum Monte Carlo. Turns out that the Hubbard model at half filling on a bipartite lattice, which is what this is, has no sign problem. So we can do quantum Monte Carlo exactly. And this is what Assad and company leveraged to conclude at the get-go that this was a spin liquid. And now we would like to use quantum Monte Carlo to decide if there's a topological degeneracy or not. Now, of course, the downside is it doesn't give us a spectra. So we're going to have to somehow figure out how, without having our hands on a spectra, we're going to decide whether or not the world looks like this. Okay, so the first thing we can do is we can say, look, we can get the energies as a function of temperature, and then we can fit the low-lying spectra. So let's do two things. Let's just pretend that there aren't these states here, that they don't exist, and let's fit the spectra, and we get a best fit for that line, and ask, does that give us the right answer for this gap? Assad and company have measured this gap in an independent way, and we find that it gives us exactly the right answer for the gap. So we pretend the states don't exist that we're looking for, and we get exactly the right answer. We put some of the states back, and we play this game again, and we get a wrong answer. Okay, this is a little bit concerning. This bodes badly for the existence of these states, but it's not conclusive. And the reason it's not conclusive is because even though the best fit doesn't seem to like it, it's not totally inconsistent with the data to have some of these states here. I can draw a line with some of these states here where the data fits reasonably well, even if it's not the best fit. Okay, so we'd like to go a further step. We'd like to do a little bit better. So the way we can do a little bit better is instead of looking at the energy, we can look at the entropy. Now the entropy is a much more annoying quantity to calculate using quantum Monte Carlo, but it can be done. It's done by thermodynamic integration. And again, we're looking for this in the infinite limit, so we expect the ground state entropy to be log 4. But we're not in the infinite limit, we're hopefully in some large limit, so we expect the low temperature entropy to plateau at log 4, and then eventually go to 0 once we hit the ground state. So we do this calculation, we calculate the entropy, we look at the entropy as a function of temperature. This is the data points with the error bars. This is 0, log 2, log 3, log 4. You will notice a distinct lack of a plateau. Okay, so this is really not looking good. It seems that we expected the world to be like this. We expected a plateau, and we don't see it. So now, the system sizes I've done are 6 by 6 and 9 by 9, which is up to 172 particles. This one here is the 6x6, but the 9x9 looks similar. So one of the concerns is that this is not sufficiently large, and I'll say something else about that in a second. But before we say something else about that, we'd really like to quantify sort of how bad this is. I mean, there's no plateau, but can we just ask ourselves the question, are there any states down here at all? For example, maybe there's just one state that's, 40% below the spin gap or something. Could we try to rule something like that in or out? And it turns out that we can quantify how good or bad this is. So here's how we're going to do this quantification. We're going to continue looking at the entropy, and then we're going to write up some model spectra. We're going to draw some model spectra. So our model spectra is only going to have 5 or 6 states in it, 4 or 5 states in it. So model spectra 1 is in red, has the ground state and the spin triplet. Model spectra 2 has the ground state, the spin triplet, and this green state. Model spectra 3 has the ground state, the spin triplet, and this purple state. And then model spectra 3 has the ground state, the spin triplet, and this blue state. Okay. So now we have these different possible models for the low-lying spectra. And those correspond to the red curve, the green curve, the purple curve, and the blue curve. Now, the model spectra I wrote down only has 4 or 5 states. There might be gobs of things going on up here. Lots, 4 to the n other states running around, 4 to the n minus 4 other states running around up there. But it turns out for low temperatures, no matter what I do up here, it can only bring these curves up. Look at convexity of entropy and other things, those curves only come up. So now you can compare these curves to the data. You can say, look, if the real spectra, if our model spectra, the spectra with a blue thing here, looks like this or higher, it is inconsistent with the data. There is no way that there is a single state, much less the 3 states that we need, sitting at 0.03. Because if that state was there, this curve would have to be lower. In fact, there is no way, it's really hard to be consistent with the data to even have a single state at 0.1 or lower. That state is not consistent with the data. So essentially what I'm telling you is I'm telling you that not only don't we see the 4 states that you need, that we really can't put any states below the spin gap. Okay, you might be able to put them like there. We can't put any states non-trivially below the spin gap and still be consistent with the quantum Monte Carlo data for the finite size systems that we're doing. Yes?
Just to clarify, model spectra is where you expect the ground states to be, and you either have 0 states below that in the red case, then 1 state always, but getting closer to it in the green, purple, and blue case.
That's exactly what I've done. And I've done this also, I'm not showing it here, but I've done it with 2 states below and 3 states below. So the point is we've drawn a spectra that we expect. And we say, is that consistent with what the world looks like according to the actual data? So this, this is really much stronger than the previous statement that there's no plateau. This is really saying if the states are running around, they essentially live above the spin gap. There's really no way to fix this. Okay, any other questions at this point? Yes?
So it's just meaning that your state, the ground state is a spin shipless state?
No, the first excited state is a spin shipless state.
Okay.
It means that the degenerate ground states that we expect to exist in the thermodynamic limit don't seem to exist in the low-lying spectra at all. They seem not to be there.
Okay.
For the finite size system that we're able to do. Other questions? Okay, so a common complaint is that we're doing quantum Monte Carlo. Quantum Monte Carlo often has equilibration issues. Maybe it's just stuck in some sector. Maybe we're just missing the state, and that's why we don't see it. And this is a perfectly reasonable thing to worry about. And so on this slide, I'd like to tell you why this is sort of a beautiful calculation in the sense that there's sort of a self-consistency built in that makes it very hard to miss a state. And really, I'm going to say four things, but really they all boil down to the fact that if you're calculating entropy, you know there have to be four to the n states at infinite temperature, and so it's very hard to lose a state and not see it. Okay, so the first point, which really drives to that, is that this curve integrates down to zero. We're integrating down from infinite temperature, where there are four to the n states analytically, all the way down to zero temperature, and we get zero entropy. This essentially means that we saw all the states. The world would have to have conspired in some very evil way for us to have managed to integrate exactly down to zero. I mean, is it formally impossible? No, but it means that some subset of these were higher, some subset were lower, and some magic fine-tuned way to make that happen. The second point is that both the low energy thing we did at the beginning, and the entropy, which uses the high energy curves, fit to the same number. Again, the world has to conspire now in two different ways to make those fit, the higher and low energy fit, and this integrate all the way down to zero. Thirdly, this is a super sensitive, painful, annoying calculation. You breathe on it wrong, you don't extrapolate your time step errors carefully, you don't do everything really, really right, and you get answers that look insane. So it's very, very hard to believe that it's stuck in half of these and not stuck in the other, and it gets one sector sometimes and the other sector other times, and you miss a state. And finally, and this is really the point, the scale is really set by infinite t. If the state was gone the entire time, you'd integrate down to one. If it was gone some percent of the time, you largely, it's hard to integrate below one. So really what I'm saying is if we make an error, it's usually an error biasing you to seeing topological degeneracy, not an error in the other way around. Okay, so it's a hard to screw up. It's easy to screw up, but once you have this data, it's hard to see how you could be missing a state. So what's going on? What about the spin liquid that Assad and company have promised? Well, there's a, go ahead. Well, in the low temperature limit, there's going to be a suppression of the tunneling rate. That's right. The quantum Monte Carlo is not necessarily sensitive to that because the quantum Monte Carlo is working in this funny auxiliary field space. Maybe it's sensitive, but it's not obvious that it's sensitive. But the point is, even though there's this low tunneling, we can't be missing the state. Because if we were missing the state, the entropy can't come out right. The entropy can't come down to zero. I'm sorry, even at low temperature, if you miss the state, if for example, I play this game, I say, look, the state is always there down to this temperature, and then I just remove it from my quantum Monte Carlo. It's not there anymore. Then I would have to integrate down to something above one. I can't get this number right. So that just, it just can't happen. So that's sort of the nice feature about working in this sort of entropic calculation. Is that you can't be accidentally forgetting about a state. Okay, so now what's up? I mean, we said they had strong evidence for spin liquid, and I'm saying, I can't find the topological degeneracy. So there's a boring possibility. The boring possibility is I told you what should happen for the larger thermodynamic limit. I told you I did this for 162 particles. Maybe 162 is too small. Maybe the real world looks like this. Here's the true ground state, here's the triplet, and the other states are all above it. We know they decay exponentially fast to the ground state, but there's some prefactor, and maybe 162 isn't big enough. Okay, this is entirely plausible, and there's not much I can say about it. The lesson there is topological degeneracies are hard, and for the rest of the talk, we'll think about wave functions and not worry about them, and think about other ways to learn about spin liquids. Okay? There's an exotic possibility. This isn't a spin liquid at all, that it's really been misidentified. But Assad and company tell us there's no symmetry breaking. So this is a newish sort of thing. This is now a no symmetry breaking state that isn't a spin liquid. These things have been talked about before. I think Sabir has one of these, although, no, Sabir does not have one of these. You've forgotten about it, okay.
That's quite possible.
All right, I think these have been looked at occasionally. There are two types of these things. One which is connected to a band insulator, which this can't be for reasons that I can explain, and one that isn't. I think people have written down wave functions that look like this, but no one knows of a Hamiltonian that gives one of these things. So that's one possibility, yes? I think by definition, if you are a spin liquid, then you are topological. That's sort of a criterion. So this exotic thing is, in some sense, a non-topological spin liquid. So Hastings' theorem, right, it doesn't really say anything about spin liquids. It just says if you have one state per unit cell and you don't break any symmetry and you're gapped, then you have to be topological. So right, this is this new animal I'm talking about. You could call it a non-topological spin liquid if you want, but I think that's sort of a misnomer. So that's really sort of the exotic possibility. I mean, the other possibility is something's broken somewhere. We have data from different groups that say different things. I mean, they're not in contradiction. They just seem to be a little bit confusing. Maybe some extrapolation somewhere isn't quite right. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the Hubbard model and the honeycomb lattice. That's sort of my first tale. If there are particular questions about what's going on there, now is a good time to ask about. All right, so for the rest of the talk, we're going to forget about the Hubbard model. We're only going to be talking about spin wave functions, the honeycomb and the Kagame lattice, Heisenberg models. And we're going to not ask at all about topological degeneracy anymore. What we're going to be asking about.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
When you're in this very low temperature limit,
that's
can you by hand insert flux pi or something in the Monte Carlo and see if it changes anything?
Can I insert flux pi into the Hamiltonian or into the wave function?
Yeah.
It's not obvious to me how in the Hubbard model you could introduce it into the state. You could introduce it, you could twist the boundary conditions on the Hamiltonian, which is essentially inserting into the torus.
Sure.
And you could look at the energies, and
yeah.
I've talked to Assad about potentially doing this. But I haven't done it, and as far as I know, they haven't done that yet.
So usually the different topological sectors are connected by these highly monomer
things, right.
Which means at some point it's also possible that you freeze out of sampling. But this also means that there should exist some move which takes you between them.
Yeah, so two things. One, naively, that's probably true. You might freeze out of sampling, although because we're in this weird auxiliary space, I'm not sure that's generically true. But the second thing is, if you did freeze out, then your entropy would tell you that. So that's sort of the whole point of...
Before you froze out, and once you did, you go to zero.
Well, once you did, you couldn't, the point is, once you did, you couldn't get this to integrate down to zero.
Would you get a plateau before freezing? Because you'd be sampling only a set of small states, and then you freeze, and you'd only be sampling one state.
No, it's a little bit different, because this entropy curve is actually coming from an integral over all of the energies from infinite temperature. So once you've frozen out, once you've frozen out, you have the right information down to a point, and then you have the wrong information in that integral afterwards.
Right, so you'd be stuck at log 4.
You would be stuck at log 4 or something if you lost one state. So the point here is this entropy curve. Each of these points aren't independently generated. They're generated from an energy coming from infinite temperature. That's right. That's, I mean, the concern is you do freeze out, but this sort of protects you against that somehow.
It shouldn't cause this error.
That's right. It should cause an error in the direction that you want, not not in sort of the other way.
How would
I rule out what?
Band insulator.
Band insulator. Okay, that's a great question. So the question is, how do you rule out that this is actually a band insulator? So that's something I've thought about and am working on. So one thing you could do is you could say, look, let us, if the band insulator, what do we mean by that? It's an interacting system. What we mean by that is we mean it's adiabatically connected to some non-interacting band insulator. So you can pick your favorite non-interacting band insulator, and you can try to adiabatically connect it. And you should expect either to see the gap go to zero or not. If the gap goes to zero, then it's not connected to it. And if it doesn't, then in fact, you are looking at a band insulator. And okay, I'm in the middle of doing this calculation, but it's sufficiently preliminary that I don't have data that I'm convinced enough to sort of say in public. The other statement I should say is, if it's a band insulator, there ought to be some symmetry breaking. Symmetric Hamiltonian, the band insulator has some symmetry breaking because all band insulators and honeycombs have broken symmetries. This is just an independent fact.
Is there a proof? Or?
Yeah, there, I mean, it's not my proof, but there is a proof that all band insulators on the honeycomb have broken symmetries. And so you ought to see broken symmetry degenerate states. And the fact that we don't see any degenerate states is evidence against it being some sort of band insulator. That there are no broken symmetry states? I don't think it's a simple argument. I think someone has, I think it's Elliot Leib who's done this, but I'm not sure. Someone has enumerated all of the ways in which you can essentially break the degeneracy on the honeycomb because these are enumeratable because you have these Dirac points. They've looked at all of them and they've said, okay, none of these have no broken symmetries. I don't think there's a simple sort of hand-wavy way to see this. Okay, any other questions about this part of the talk? Okay, in the next part of the talk, what we'll try to do is we will try to answer the following questions. There's an analytic story. People have thought about spin liquids for a long time, resonance valence bond, projective symmetry group, et cetera, about what these Z2 spin liquids should look like. And we'd like to know, do these wave functions work reasonably for the numerically discovered spin liquids that people have? And if so, can we identify which one of these many spin liquids, many of these projective symmetry groups, the spin liquid is? So that's the game for the rest of the talk. So I'd actually just like to clarify what I'm not going to do for the rest of the talk. Because when people talk about doing variational Monte Carlo, writing down wave functions, they often mean two different things. And it helps to clarify which of these two things you're doing. They're both useful and valuable. Let me just tell you which I'm doing. You can do two things when you do variational Monte Carlo. You can write down a simple wave function. Projected BCS or projected Goodswiller, something that you look at it and say, look, I understand this spin liquid just by looking at the wave function. Okay, when you do that, you're not going to have perfectly good energies because you only have a certain number of parameters and these things are simple, but it allows you to make direct connection to analytic theory. There's another approach. You say, look, my goal is to get really exactly very, very good energies. And I don't care if my wave function looks like a mess. So here I say I'm going to do exact diagonalization and I get a bunch of numbers, or I'm going to do matrix product states or some quantum chemistry expansion or diffusion Monte Carlo or something like this. Looking at the wave function doesn't tell me anything. And then if I have to learn about it, I'm going to have to poke it with correlators and things. Well, you already know that's hard for spin liquids. Because spin liquids are these featureless things and most correlators don't tell you anything. So for most of this talk, I'll stick with approach one. I'll say, look, we're going to write down simple things, even though this may cost us a little bit in energy. Okay, so I said, look, the name of the game, what we're trying to do now, is we're trying to compare this to some analytic understanding of what spin liquids are. And so if I'm going to do that, I better tell you what the analytic understanding of spin liquids is. So how do people think about spin liquids? Well, one way people think about spin liquids is in this Anderson-RVB approach, this resonant valence bond approach. So they say, this is really how a spin liquid should look. You should have some wave function, and it should consist of a bunch of singlets. So here I have a dimer covering, or part of a dimer covering, but you should mentally think of this as a whole dime recovering. And to tell what the amplitude is for this dime recovering, each singlet has some value, and I multiply the product of those values. And that gives me the amplitude for this dime recovering. Then I sum over all possible dime recoverings. This is the resonant valence bond state. Anderson wrote this down a long time ago. And people think about spin liquids in this way. Then they say, look, if I have a gap spin liquid, the short range RVB singlets are the primary ones. You might imagine that if most of my singlets are short range, I have to break one of them to get an excitation. It costs me energy. If instead I have a gapless spin liquid, they're going to be RVB singlets of all size. And then it doesn't cost me very much to break them. Okay, so you might say, great, you have a wave function, just play your game with this wave function and be done with it. But it turns out that this doesn't work very well, because this wave function is a mess to use numerically, because even with variational Monte Carlo, it has a sign problem. And this is because these different singlets are not orthogonal to each other. So typically, you write down something in an orthogonal basis, and because the cross terms are zero, variational Monte Carlo is easy. But here, the cross terms are not zero, and this is a mess. Some people do it, but it's a mess. So we're going to avoid doing that, and we're going to try to think about spin liquids in a slightly different way. So the other way people think about spin liquids is the following. They say, look, take a Hamiltonian and write it down there, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and then do some Schwinger fermion decomposition. So write the spins as a set of fermions and add some constraint so that these fermions are stuck one per site. So you have some mean field Hamiltonian, a BCS Hamiltonian. You solve the mean field Hamiltonian, you get some wave function. You project that wave function to project out the aphysical part of the Hilbert space. Okay? And it turns out this is what this looks like in K-space. And real space is a determinant of this pairing function phi. And this pairing function phi and the cost of a dimer, that pairing function phi and the RVB wave functions, are almost the same thing. They're morally essentially the same thing. They are exactly the same thing if your dimer covering is planar, because there's a gauge transformation to go between them. If your dimer covering isn't planar, they're almost the same thing up to a sign that you can't control. So we'll morally say they're essentially the same thing. It might not surprise you that just like there are gap spin liquids, there are gapless spin liquids that can be constructed in the same way, except for there you have some projection of some tight binding Hamiltonian that has a gapless state. Okay, so one more slide on the analytic understanding, and then we'll get back to thinking about whether this analytic understanding really works in the honeycomb case and the Kagame case. Of course, my computer is uncooperative, and sorry about this, I've never had it be so fussy. Okay, I can see it, you still can't, good. Okay, so now you have all of these different Hamiltonians, which correspond to all of these different wave functions. And now what we want to do, or what people have done, sort of Wang and company, is they said, look, we're going to group these different wave functions into different phases. And at the end of the day, one of our goals today will be to identify which phase these spin liquids are in. So here's the one slide explanation to projective symmetry groups. So it is a fact that you might have two different mean field Hamiltonians that after projection give you the same spin wave function. Okay, great. So now you want to classify, you want to group all of the mean field Hamiltonians. So here's how you're going to do it. You're going to say, look, let's look at this mean field Hamiltonian. If I apply the reflection operator and then one of these gauge transformations are the things that connect things that look different but are really the same after projection, I get back to myself. Maybe if I apply the translation operator, I get back to myself. Here's a different, totally independent mean field Hamiltonian. If I apply reflection and the same gauge operator, and if I apply translation, I get back to myself. So these two Hamiltonians can get back to themselves in exactly the same way. So therefore, those two Hamiltonians are considered all part of one phase. Here's another Hamiltonian. You get back to itself by applying some Q operator. And so it's part of a different phase. And this is how you group these different wave functions, these different Hamiltonians, into different phases. And one of our goals is if these wave functions make sense for our spin liquid, we would like to identify which of the projective symmetry groups it belongs to. Okay, now there's an additional complication. This is kind of a technical complication, but it's an interesting technical complication, so I'm gonna go through it. Typically, what do? How do you play this game? Well, you have some mean field Hamiltonians, you pick some parameters, you evaluate the energy, and then you pick better parameters, and you keep going on and on. But the world is sometimes not nice to you, and sometimes there is degeneracy in the single particle BGG spectrum. This is particularly bad in the Kagame lattice, where sometimes you have macroscopic degeneracy. And so then you don't know how to fill up your Fermi C, and you don't know how to pick your states. Okay, so this is a typical problem, and there's a very typical solution to this problem. You give up and you forget about the state and ignore it. That is the typical solution. It's a little bit of an unsatisfying solution. You'd really like to include this state and these states because it might be that these are the winning states. These are the important ones. So we have sort of a way around this issue. So typically when you do this, what everyone does is they optimize the mean field Hamiltonians, but you don't have to do that. You could imagine instead there's these parameters phi. These are morally the cost of a dimer. And you could just say, look, I'm just going to directly optimize the cost of a dimer, these phis. So you have a lot more parameters now. Now you have n squared different parameters. So you've got to use a lot, much more sophisticated optimization techniques. But you can do this. And then you can go ahead and sort of walk downhill in this space of phi. And this lets you access these macroscopically degenerate states that no one really knows how to access in any other way. Of course, it's great to have a solution, but every solution causes more problems. So now, instead of having a nice mean field Hamiltonian, you have some bunch of numbers that correspond to phi. And now you want to know, which spin liquid am I? Am I a spin liquid really at all? Okay, and we have a solution for this. We've come up with a way to identify whether or not you're a spin liquid and which spin liquid you are at all. What we do is we take our pairing function phi, we write out the anomalous density matrix, and from the anomalous density matrix, we can define a gauge invariant quantity in all the sites and all the bonds. And if this gauge invariant quantity has the same symmetries as, say, the Kagame lattice, then it's a spin liquid. And then we can define essentially a flux. This is sort of an SU2 variant of a U1 flux. We take the anomalous density matrix, we define a flux matrix. We multiply this matrix around a loop. And then we can pull out a phase. And different spin liquids have different fluxes. So this is a trick that lets you start with a pairing function and work out by looking at gauge invariant quantities whether or not you're a spin liquid, and if so, which amongst this family of spin liquids you happen to be. Okay, so I should point out that it really is true that not all phis are spin liquids. So here we have a case in the honeycomb lattice where we optimize our phis. We play this game I told you about, you have n squares phis, and you optimize them all. And for some values of J2 over J1, the phis are symmetric. They obey some of the symmetries of the honeycomb lattice. But then at some value of J2 over J1, they lose their symmetry. They break the symmetry, they look different, they are no longer a spin liquid. So it turns out that sometimes these pairing functions give you spin liquids, and sometimes they don't. That'll be important for sort of the end of this story on the Kagame. Okay, so let's just step back. I've said a lot of things. Let's just sort of review where we are. We want to think about these spin liquids from the perspective of wave functions. This means thinking about the projected BCS states, thinking about the states that have to do with the analytic PSG framework. And this encompasses both spin liquids and other things. There are some technical issues we've overcome. We figured out how to overcome them. So now let's actually try to answer the question I'm asking. Do the spin liquids that show up on these systems, are they characterized by these analytic functions? And if so, which one are they? I'm going to tell you the answer for the honeycomb. I'm going to tell you the answer for the Kagame. Then I'm going to sort of drill down in detail. The answer for the honeycomb is the best projected BCS state looks like a spin liquid. It has very good energies compared to the exact results. We can identify which spin liquid it is, and we can tell you why. the qualitative understanding of why it's a good spin liquid. This is not comparing with the Monte Carlo Hubbard model. This is comparing with the energies with some exact diagonalization on small systems. That's right. It's much harder to compare directly against the Hubbard model results because they're in a different Hilbert space, and it's not clear quite how to do that. Part of the story, which I won't tell you, is we have compared some things, dimer-dimer correlation functions and things, and they look similar-ish. Take that as you wish. The Kagame lattice, the story is different. The winning state appears not to be a spin liquid, but slightly not a spin liquid. So this is a little bit funny, and I'll tell you sort of what's going on there in a minute. But let me start with the honeycomb. This is an example of how the optimization works. You start at some energies, and we start at all sorts of different places. For the Kagame, we actually start with each PSG that people have written down. We optimize from there to try to make sure we don't get stuck, et cetera, et cetera. And as you optimize, your energy comes down and then plateaus. And that's how these things work. Okay, so let's talk about the honeycomb lattice. Which spin liquid wins? Does it sort of do a good job, et cetera, et cetera? So in the honeycomb lattice, the spin liquid that wins is this SPS spin liquid, which was originally suggested by Lewin Ran from some mean field analysis. Remember, these spin liquids correspond to some mean field Hamiltonian that we project. So let me tell you what the mean field Hamiltonian is. It's the tight binding model on the graphene lattice. And then it's a BCS term. This BCS term has pairing between AA sites and BB sites. And the pairing between the AA sites is delta e to the I theta. And the pairing between the BB sites is delta e to the minus I theta. And you can go ahead and you can vary delta and theta, and you can find a state that has very low energy. And then for sort of largish J2 over J1, this energy is reasonably good compared to the exact diagonalization. And everything seems to sort of work out reasonably there. OK, that's good. We played our game. We found our state. We said we can name you. You are SPS. But it would be a little bit nice if we could also sort of understand why. Why this guy amongst all the possible people? And so let me go ahead and let me try to motivate why this is a good state. OK, so the Hamiltonian, there's a J1 term and a J2 term. Quantum mechanics is linear. The J1 term is much larger. Let's understand for a minute what sort of wave functions, what are the key characteristic of wave functions that make J1 happy? The key characteristic of wave functions that make J1 happy is they obey the Marshall sine rule. So how much time do I have left? We'll motivate whether I go into detail about the Marshall sine rule. How many? 15, OK. So I will tell you quickly what the Marshall sine rule is, but I won't tell you the proof of why this is the case, although the proof is very cute. So the Marshall sine rule is just a prescription. It's a prescription that says, look, this is the sign, it just defines the sign structure of the wave function. So it says, look, define the stagger case to be positive, define any nearest neighbor spin flip as negative, define any nearest neighbor spin flip as positive again, any nearest neighbor spin flip as negative. So I've given you a prescription. It's not obvious the prescription I've given you is consistent. You might imagine that I have some loop that requires me to define things in two different ways. But on bipartite lattice, what I've just described is a consistent definition. It's a consistent prescription. If you think about it for a minute or two, that will become clear. And this is called the Marshall sine rule. And you can quantify how badly you break the Marshall sine rule by this quantity. I'm not going to tell you why that quantifies it unless we have extra time at the end, but it quantifies it. And so then you can say, look, this is a sign structure. I haven't told you why it's special. But it turns out you can prove that this is the sign structure you want if you want to minimize the J1 energy. Forget about J2, which is a frustrating term, and just worry about J1. If you want to minimize J1, you must use this sign structure. In some sense, you can say this defines the nodal surface, the sign structure of the dominant term in the Hamiltonian. So you look at your Hamiltonian, you say, what's most important? Well, J1 is most important. It's 1, and J2 is 0.1 or 0.2 or whatever. And so the nodal surface, sort of the main sign structure of your Hamiltonian, is being dominated by this sign structure. OK, and you can ask, is this really what's going on in our case? So let's say you take this wave function and you turn off theta. So now it's just some S wave superconducting thing. And you look at how badly it breaks the Marshall sine rule. It's a little bit hard to see because I don't have these labeled very much, but this is a function of Monte Carlo time. And the key point here is this is order one, and it breaks it almost all the time. Now you turn on theta to the right parameter, and you ask, how badly does it break the Marshall sine rule? This is now order 0.05. These are very different scales. And it breaks it only, I don't know, 30% of the time or something. So for all intents and purposes, this wave function that we found restores the Marshall sine rule. It obeys the sine structure, the nodal surface of the Marshall sine rule. In some sense, these nodes defined by this thing matter. And this is really why this is a good spin liquid wave function. There's a J2 here, but the J2 affects some of the amplitudes, it affects some other things, it doesn't affect the sine structure. That's already scaffolded by the important term. So the nice thing about this qualitative feature is you say, look, you wrote down something that's essentially an effective spin model of the Hubbard model. But really, you've only done J1, J2, there's a J3, there's a ring exchange, there's the other things. But all of those are also going to be small. If you believe this story, then there's good reason to believe that the sine structure is still going to be primarily dominated by the J1 energies. If that's the case, this spin liquid we found is still going to be a relatively good one, even in the face of these other terms. And that's sort of a nice feature of this sort of qualitative aspect. The other nice thing is when people think about these wave functions, they think about PSGs and how do you connect them to semi-metals and all of this. And this is somehow a qualitative microscopic understanding of what's going on. You got the signs right, and therefore you win. You've got the nodes right, and therefore you win. All right, so I'm done talking about the honeycomb for a minute. For the remaining 10-ish minutes, I will talk about the Kagame lattice. Do people have questions about the honeycomb? Okay, so what do we do in the honeycomb? We said, it looks like a spin liquid, and here's its name. We've identified it. And here's qualitatively why we think it's good. The Kagame, the story is different because it doesn't look like a spin liquid, sort of. Okay, so let me tell you what we do. So again, we play this game. We write down the pairing function. We start from 8 zillion PSGs, and we do all sorts of sophisticated optimization techniques. We try to figure out what the best projected BCS wave function is. And I've told you many of those projected BCS wave functions are spin liquids, but some of them are not. In fact, many of them are not. So when we play this game, we then have this measure, this gauge invariant quantity. And this gauge invariant quantity, if it has the right symmetries, means it's a spin liquid. If it doesn't have the right symmetries, it means it's not. We can measure how far away it is from a spin liquid by measuring the variance of this gauge invariant quantity. So that's the game we play. We say, here's the best state, and here's how far away it is from the spin liquid. And the answer is, for the sites, 0.03, for the bonds, 0.012. Okay, what this tells you is this tells you it's not a spin liquid, or else these would be zero, but it's really, really close. So this is sort of a very strange result, actually. If I just plucked a projected BCS state at random, these numbers would be very large. If I had a valence bond solid, these numbers would be very large. But now I have something that looks a lot like a spin liquid. They're close to zero in some normalized sense, but they're not zero. And that's a strange thing. And you can ask, is there any pattern to their not zero-ness? And that's what this picture is showing you. So red means they're above sort of the average state, and blue means they're below the average state. As best as I can tell, there's no rhyme or reason for who's above or who's below. Okay. So you might say, look, this is crazy. You just have some numerical problem. It's working its way to zero, and you just stopped before it got to zero. Okay. And I will address that question in a second, because that's an important question. Let me say two more things about this state before I do, though. Point one is you say, look, OK, it's not a spin liquid, but can you tell me which spin liquid it's close to? And I said a couple slides ago, I said we had a way of doing that by looking at fluxes of this spin liquid. We have this gauge invariant fluxes that we define. And these fluxes look like the Dirac spin liquid. We haven't totally And they look like the Dirac spin liquid. We haven't ruled out that they don't look like anybody else yet either. But as best we can tell, it is close to sort of this Wend Dirac spin liquid that was written down, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago by Wend. The other question you can ask is you can ask, how much are you winning? I mean, I just told you our energies are better. They're better than any spin liquid anyone has written down, other than the DMRG state. How much are you anywhere close to the DMRG state? So here is the Dirac spin liquid written down by Wend. Here is the best projected BCS state that we've written down. And it's lower, but it's not much lower. The DMRG energies are way down here. So two takeaways. One, the best projected BCS state is far from the DMRG energies. So probably projected BCS isn't a good way to think about this. Though I'll say a couple more words about that in a second. Two, the best state is not a spin liquid at all, which is a little bit strange. And it's not a spin liquid, only a very tiny bit. Okay, so let me address this question. Are you sure this is not a numerical issue? Are you sure it's not sort of working its way to being zero and just hasn't gotten there yet? Because that's certainly what I thought when I saw this. I thought, we're on route to a spin liquid and we just haven't made it. Okay, so we can sort of answer that question in two ways. One way we can say, look, let's look at the energy as a function of the asymmetry. If we were on our way to the spin liquid, as the asymmetry got better, as we got closer to the spin liquid, the energy ought to come down. But it's exactly the opposite that we see. As the asymmetry gets worse, as it moves further away from the spin liquid, the energy comes down. We're actually working our way away from the spin liquid, not toward it. The other thing you could say is you could say, look, why don't you just start with your state and search for the closest spin liquid? So I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to find the closest spin liquid. But I do know a heuristic way of finding a close spin liquid. I'll start with my state, and I'll just walk in the direction that decreases this asymmetry. We have some metric for how spin liquidy you are. I'll just walk in the direction toward a spin liquid, kind of at random. And you play this game, and you walk in a direction of a spin liquid. At the end of the day, the nearest spin liquid you find is the Dirac spin liquid, this guy over here that has higher energy that everyone's known about for a decade. That's the spin liquid you find if you sort of walk back uphill. So this is real. This is not an artifact. Somehow this asymmetry breaking is, in fact, actually there. All right, so the other thing you might say is you might say, look, you're telling me that this state does really bad. But you know what? This is some analytic theory. Really, it's supposed to get the long wavelength physics right. No one really expects it to get sort of everything about the short wavelength physics correct. So why don't you somehow check that you have the right long wavelength physics, even if the short wavelength physics isn't very good. Okay, and so here's how we're going to check that statement. We're going to say, look, take our projected BCS state that we have and multiply it by some wave function that cleans up the short range physics. Okay, so how are we going to do that? Well, we're going to write out this wave function. This is the Huys-Elser state, often known these days also by a correlated product state or entangled Plaquette state. And this wave function is the following. You say, look, I can always expand my wave function in the SZ basis. And then I just have to tell you what the amplitudes are. So what is this amplitude? The way I'm going to write that amplitude is I'm going to write it as a product of a bunch of pieces. Here I've written as pairs, but you might imagine I write it as a product of honeycombs or a product of small short-range pieces. And what this lets you do is it essentially, if you write it as a product of small short-range things, lets you clean up the short-range physics. There's some short-range physics, there's some energy that depends on it, and then you have this projected BCS state, and this lets you clean up that physics. You have n squared parameters, or 10n parameters, or 100n parameters, some number of parameters. You just optimize them all. Again, hard optimization, et cetera, technically difficult, but this is what we do. And you play this game, and what you find is you go from here to here. Well, that's not very good. I mean, we cleaned up the short range physics, and we didn't improve our energies essentially at all. I mean, okay, we added 10,000 parameters, and we improved our energies by like 0.5% or something very, very little. So that's not very reassuring at all. And then you step back and you say, look, you just told me this other story. You said in the honeycomb lattice, what really matters is the sign structure. If you just have the sign structure right, then everything sort of pushes through okay. You say, can we test that in this case? Can we just take the sign structure from this projected BCS state and see if that's any good? You can't do that quite exactly, but morally you can essentially do this. You essentially do diffusion Monte Carlo, which I'll say something about in a minute if I have time, and you can fix the sign structure with diffusion Monte Carlo, and you can say, look, does that recover all of the energy? And what you do is you find it recovers much of the, well, it recovers, I don't know, half to a third of the energy. That's still not very satisfying. I mean, we're now at the point where we're saying, look, we're going to let the analytic theory be wrong on the short-range physics and just sort of have the right nodal structure. And that's all we wanted to do is capture the sort of DMRG energetics, relaxing all of these constraints. It's still doing a pretty bad job. So it turns out that really it's looking a lot like the analytics is not right here. That somehow there's a theoretical disconnect between what people analytically have been writing down. Oops, I should try not to throw my pointer. What people have been writing down for years and years in terms of how we should think analytically about spin liquids. And then we come up with these numerical spin liquids, and we have sort of an implicit matrix product state wave function for them. And they look very, very different. They seem not to be the same thing. And it's not really clear how we bridge this disconnect. I mean, one thing that I've started trying but haven't made much progress on is say, look, maybe we can expand in this projected BCS, some sort of complete fermionic basis. Maybe we can use the PSG wave functions as sort of the zeroth order term of that expansion. Okay, and this is really just an idea. This is something I've started playing with. But it hasn't really recovered sort of the results that I want yet. Okay, so where are we so far? Well, the canonical wave functions seem good in the honeycomb case, and we can name which one it is. But in the Kagame case, they seem pretty bad. In fact, not only are they bad, but when we do the best projected BCS, it's not even a spin liquid at all. So that's a little bit strange, and it's not really clear what's going on there. Okay, so in two minutes or so, I'd like to say something about sort of the other approach that you might take for these sort of things if you didn't want to do variational Monte Carlo with simple wave functions. So this is independent of the rest of the story. This is just to say, suppose this wasn't the game you wanted to play. Suppose you didn't want to write down simple wave functions. Suppose you just wanted to get really good energetics. What would you do? You wouldn't write down simple things. You would write down complicated things. And then you would do diffusion Monte Carlo on top of it. Let me just tell you how that game works in something like the honeycomb. So the honeycomb, the variational wave functions do pretty well, but they're not exact. So here's your variational, and we don't expect them to be exact, right? We say we were going to write down simple things. So here's your variational Monte Carlo as a function of J2 over J1, and here's for the same system size exact diagonalization. And you say, look, suppose we just take this and do diffusion Monte Carlo on top of this. Diffusion Monte Carlo is a quantum Monte Carlo method where you essentially project out the excitations, but you can't exactly project out the excitations because there's a sign problem. So you project out the excitations up to a constraint of where the nodal surface is. So just morally, you want to think about it. I fix the nodal surface. I can project out the rest of the stuff as best I can. And you do this, and you go from this red line to this green line, which at least up to sort of J2 over J1 of 0.1 sits right on top of the exact diagonalization. So not only is this interesting from an algorithmic point of view, this tells us something interesting about the nodal surface of these wave functions. It tells us that the nodal surface is really well captured by the prototypical variational Monte Carlo wave function we wrote down. Okay, it gets bad over here, right, as you get up to large J2 over J1. Which is to tell us the nodal surface gets bad there, but we can continue playing this game. We can write down something a little bit more complicated, we can do diffusion Monte Carlo, and it sits on top of the exact diagonalization. So in general, we can play this game, and here's the exact diagonalization, and here's diffusion Monte Carlo. So this is just to say there are methods, there are techniques you can use to go to bigger systems, but you've lost something. Now, I don't know what these beasts are. There's no simple wave function that represents them. All I can do is poke at them with some sort of correlators. which is useful, but we've already learned is hard because spin liquids are sort of these featureless beasts. Okay, so that's all I really want to say today. There's lots of other things I work on. Here is just a flash of a slide on some Monte Carlo sampling of those things if people want to talk to me about them later. And so let me go to my conclusions. What is it we've learned? Well, we've thought about the Hubbard model on the honeycomb lattice for a little bit. And we've looked for this topological degeneracy, which is the smoking gun we expect to see. This is really a Z2 spin liquid. And we don't find it. For small systems, in fact, we rule out its existence. So either it's not there or our systems are too small. On the Heisenberg model on the honeycomb lattice, we can identify the spin liquid. We show that the analytic states are good, and we identify which one it is, and we have a qualitative understanding the nodal structure is right for why is that. And finally, on the Kagame lattice, on the Heisenberg model, the typical sort of analytic story seems not to be very good, even if you're willing to give it some leeway and say, look, get the long-range physics right, get the nodal structure right, seems not to work very well. Moreover, insofar as we look at those wave functions, the best one is not even a spin liquid. All right, thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
Using this valence bound basis, you have some way to classify different spin liquids.
Say again?
You have some way to distinguish different spin liquid phases.
When you do variational Monte Carlo, we have some way, starting with some pairing function, of telling which spin liquid phase it's in. That's right.
So is it the same as PSG? Or
Yeah. We identify which PSG it's in. It's just that the naive way of doing that is you have a Hamiltonian. And we don't have a Hamiltonian. We have some different representation. So we essentially have a technical trick, an important trick, but a technical trick that lets us start from this different representation and identify which of the PSG spin liquids it represents.
Exactly the same as PSG?
That's right. This is just identifying which PSG it is. It's exactly the same. In fact, what we did is just, as I said, we found a way to go from this different representation of the pairing function to which one of the PSGs they are. It's always one of the PSGs or not a spin liquid.
I'm asking this because there are some phases where even though they have same PSG, they are in different class. PSGs are complex words. I was wondering whether.
Okay, so yeah, this would only capture those phases if those phases could also be written in this projected BCS form. If they can, I mean, this is the whole problem with variational Monte Carlo, right? You're only as good as your variational subclass that you live in. We've worked hard over the years to enlarge the class we can work with because now we can optimize 10,000 parameters or something. But still, I mean, you're only as good as sort of your how innovative you are in writing down large classes of wave functions. So right, these wouldn't be captured by this story unless they happen to be of this projected BCS form.
Questions? Let's try it again.